You're listening to the Portland Art Museum podcast, a community-driven audio series brought to you by, well, you. If you have an idea for an episode of the podcast, fill out the form at pam.to/podcast idea, and we'll do our best to make your idea come to life. On the last episode, we heard from Charlene Vickers, an artist living in Vancouver, British Columbia. On this final podcast in the Map Is Not the Territory series, we hear from Mary Ann Peters, an artist living in Seattle, Washington. Relevant links are included in this episode's description, and a full transcript can be found at portlandartmuseum.org/podcast. I'm Grace Cook Anderson, the Arlene and Harold Schnitzer Curator of Northwest Art. You'll hear my voice from time to time, but only when necessary. Until then, this is Mary Ann Peters.
My name is Mary Ann Peters. I'm an artist. I live and work in Seattle, Washington. I've been living and working here for half my life and then some. And I came here from Los Angeles, from the Los Angeles area, Santa Barbara, and never thought I'd stay, but here I am. You know, I think I just had an inclination towards being an artist as a kid. I had older brother and sister, and so I was by myself a little bit when I was a kid, because they were off being teenagers or whatever. And I just entertained myself, and then I was the kid that had the eye-hand coordination, got asked to do all those little things you do in school, posters and whatever. And I always thought I would use art as a conduit for social services. I never imagined that I was going to be able to make a career out of being a practicing visual artist. I'm not practicing, by the way. I went and got a master's degree at the University of Washington, which is why I came here. Michael Spafford was one of my key, I'd have to definitely call him a mentor, although I think he would question that. I mean, he just was somebody that taught me how to think in a compositional way and how to be self-critical in a proactive way, and to understand that if you have an idea, it'll come back. It's not like just off in the ether. So to trust your instincts on trying things that may not make sense to you. So I credit Michael with my education, with really kind of affirming my education. And then right out of graduate school, I went into a collective studio, and I have to credit those artists. They were all practicing artists, and they were fully engaged in a lot of things we take for granted now, from video to printmaking, sculpture, painting, everything, what, you know, performance. And I was somewhat of a naive artist. I went to school because I had the skills, and I didn't understand it really as a, what I would have to say is an overlay on cultural practices. And those people, Carl Chu, Nori Sato, Bill Ritchie, Sherry Markowitz, Nancy Mead, Dennis Evans, there were all these artists that had just got spit out of the University of Washington. And they made this collective studio and pulled me in. And that was definitely my maturation as an artist. And I credit them for that. Well, I think there was certainly a tradition, or at least a discipline, of artists and art therapy focused ideas. And I quickly dismissed those because I don't really actually think of the arts that way. It can be therapeutic, but I didn't necessarily want to follow a construct that was aligned with art therapy. So I could envision myself as an artist in residence in some sort of social service facility, or I could imagine that I wouldn't try to make a career of fine art, that I would teach, or some sort of alignment that would have been besides myself, entertaining myself. And in truth, that's happened as an artist. I've done a lot of work that's outside the realm of my studio that has been proactive for the arts in the Northwest and nationally. And that just fits my personality, I think. Yeah. Well, for me, the Seattle creative community is endless, you know, because I do try to pay attention to all the layers of it. I mean, every artist community has its own neighborhoods. And there are some that I don't have access to as regularly as others. But I try to see the work. I try and see as many people's exhibitions as possible because I feel like I owe them that respect, the respect of their effort. And so that way I'm familiar and I have entree and conversations with artists from multiple layers of the art world. I also worked on First Amendment rights in the arts, which put me in kind of in front of the camera, actually, learning how to go to bat for artists when they feel like they're being censored, or to help them understand the difference between an agreement that has had its failings and censorship. And they're different. They can be different. And I learned a lot doing that. And so I've been fortunate. I can move in a lot of different directions in the art world in Seattle. A couple of years ago, after managing and being a partner in an alternative space, that's not the right word, but it was a communal studio space called Noodleworks. I was in a building in Pioneer Square that had a fire. And when that fire happened, we were displaced, of course, and needed to find a new space. So myself and two friends found a space that was 6,700 square feet of empty warehouse space right at the edge of the International District. And we made 10 studios, including two live workspaces. So I knew what kind of studio community I wanted to be a part of and what I didn't want to do anymore, which was basically worry about all these other people. So when we gave up that lease, this was 2 years ago, it was brought to my attention that Equinox Studio, where I am now, was having an opening. It is hard to get into this facility. There's a lot of people that want to work here. But I think that my experience was part of the reason they were interested in having me work here. And I was in need of a new space that would give me versatility because I have, right now, I have a variety of projects I'm working on that go from my private work to big public art projects. So I came in here and here I am.
Equinox is a remarkable artist community in the Georgetown neighborhood of Seattle. What appears to be an industrial back road soon reveals itself once you realize that the giant rusted fixtures are actually welded into sculptural shapes and designs. Hidden behind street signs are displays of public art. The Equinox building itself appears to be a factory, but the roof is lined with giant golden eggs. When you walk inside, the walls are covered in advertisements for art shows, and as you can probably imagine, pieces by the Equinox artists. Marianne's studio is a loft with plenty of space for her large sculptures, and a loft area where giant windows allow natural light to spill across the entire space.
Equinox, the beauty of it is that it is not only a deep-seated Georgetown community, but it's got artists who are doing certain kinds of, what would you say? The artisan community here is enormous. The skill base is enormous. I'm kind of probably one of a minority of people that are working within the art world as I do. I think most people have a much more grounded, possibly, and focused use of their skills. And it's just a gift. As I was saying, I feel like there are things now where I can have an idea, which is going to happen with my show that I'm producing for the Portland Art Museum. There will be work in there that I can do because there was somebody here that answered my question on building something I was thinking about.
Marianne is alluding to impossible monuments, the gatekeeper's promise. It's a tall structure made of welded steel, glycerin, and jewelry. Having seen the many steel sculptures that surround the Equinox studios, it is not surprising that Marianne was able to find a welding coach.
So Equinox is at once an artist space, but it's definitely a community center. And Sam Farazano is the man behind it. And Sam and I have known each other since, I don't know, we've known each other close to 30 years. He's been doing this. He can't stop doing it. He's actually an artist, but he doesn't get a chance to make his own work. He's convinced to make a new South End arts community for the city of Seattle, and he's doing it, and this is one of them.
Having worked in the city for so many years, Mary Ann's practice and influence is widely present in Seattle. Even more so, her studio. That's why we asked her how her environment influences her work.
Well, this environment is good because it's two levels, right? So I can imagine myself, I can visualize various perspectives for work. But if you mean how does it psychically inform me, I would say that I don't feel the weight of the weather, because I don't have, my natural light is on the second level. And I've made myself a bowl of light here so that I'm just in the comfort zone of this very even keeled kind of space. And I've moved here at a time when I've been following a trajectory of thinking that this is only bolstering that work. And so I feel like this environment is conducive to me getting at things I don't even know what they are yet. To be an artist, it has to be sort of so integrated into the way that you spend your days that you don't question it as something that's worthwhile or something that has some sort of precedence for other things. It made me understand it as a job, and I take it seriously. I come to my studio most days. I understand that there are challenges for me to resolve and to apply my particular skills to, and I always have some aspect of my thinking that is clumsy and in that area of I don't know how this works, and that keeps me going. But I think first and foremost, I make sure that the person that is most, feels compelled by the work is me. If it's not interesting to me, it's certainly not going to be interesting to someone else. So I don't let anything out of here that I'm not feeling fairly strong about. I don't make work for the production of it. I make work for the impact of it, and have been fortunate to have that kind of support to do that. As a graduate student, I had the clarity of mind to understand that if I was going to be an artist, I might be working with a commercial gallery. And I didn't really know what that meant. So I went to one of the largest galleries in Seattle. It was the Linda Ferris Gallery. And I went to Linda Ferris and I said, I will work for you for free. I just want to know how the system works. And I did do that. I did it all through my graduate, my last year of graduate work. And then I started installing shows for her. And then I showed my work with her. I've always had a kind of queasy relationship with power constructs in the arts. So I never really invited her to my studio until she asked. Same was true with being able to escort other curators or artists around town. If they asked to see my work, I always, of course, wanted them to, but I didn't see it as my privilege to just kind of take advantage of them. I've always been kind of hyper aware of taking advantage of people. But thankfully, Linda Ferris became quite an important figure in my life. She really allowed me to mature as an artist, and she was loyal to the end. And there was an end. I ended up leaving her gallery after 11 years, which was kind of a shock to people that were involved in the gallery and those that were watching my career, because it was a successful one. But I just felt like I had lost interest in the commercial gallery system, and that I was taking someone's place that might really enjoy it. And there were things I wanted to know. I wanted to know how to do large-scale work. I wanted to do temporary work. I wanted to do public artwork. And the only way I could do it, I felt, was to leave. And I did. And I was out of the gallery system for quite a few years, and then went back in, and then came out and went back in. And now I show my work with James Harris. And that's been a good relationship for me. But I really see these figures as they're signposts, you know. It's like, go this way until it doesn't make sense to you. And then you have to think of your own trajectory as an artist and what it is you want to do, which brings me to now. Well, the body of work that I've been working on for the last about 4 years now came because of visiting the Middle East. My family is Lebanese, or some would identify them as Syrian Lebanese, because when my family immigrated to the United States, there was no Lebanon. And I had always been interested in less westernized cultures, although Lebanon is a very westernized culture. When I was in college, I was an exchange student in Pakistan, and I went back to that part of the world after I graduated, newly married, and traveled overland from Turkey through Iran and Afghanistan and Pakistan and India and back. And it further cemented my interest in trying to address various kinds of aesthetics and also various premises for making work, from those that are socially relevant to just the decorative arts. I also come from a really active family. My sister is involved in global media and has been for decades. She's also a radio overseer. She worked on the and was the director of the, what would you call it, of the studio at the University of California in Santa Barbara. Her husband is a very respected scholar, a black scholar. As a young adult, I was introduced to the world of civil rights and social activism because of my sister's marriage and because I was being raised at a time when there was a collision of events in the United States and elsewhere. I had not been to the Middle East. I had always been alluding in my work to non-Western cultures, but I felt that I wanted to move beyond the sentiment of cultural ties and try and look and understand things from a stronger historical and interpretive stance. So in 2010, I went to Lebanon. The Arab Spring happened. The Arab Spring collapsed. And I found myself thinking, in this discussion of multiculturalism and the arts, one facet that is constantly sort of swum around or not included are artists who are from the Arab world or that have Arab ties. And I felt like if there was anybody that should be tackling the crossover of world events and the Arab world on U.S. policy and on U.S. experience, it should be somebody who has that association, and that happened to be me. But I was very hesitant for a long time to do that because I am a second generation Arab American, and I find that all those alliances have their responsibilities and their perspectives, and you need to understand them. And once I convinced myself that having that perspective was valuable to the larger discussion, then I started making a series of pieces called Impossible Monuments. The Impossible Monuments, by my read, are those incidents or events that are under the radar but feed larger topics and deserve reverence, but they will never be elevated to the status of a monument. The very first impossible monument that I made was I bronzed a set of pita breads. That was based on having read that there's a drought in Syria. There's a drought in that region. It's a long-standing drought. It's not just contemporary, but it has fed the contemporary civil unrest in Syria. And I felt that people didn't understand that. They didn't know about it, or it wasn't in the larger discussion of what's going on there. And so I made a work that was a massive decorative rug that was made entirely out of baking flour. And it was called Impossible Monument on My Eyes and My Head. That means, in Arabic, that expression, on my eyes and my head, means I would do anything for you. And if you've traveled in Muslim countries, or if you've traveled in non-Christian countries that have alignments with Islam or the various extensions of Islam, that's a common tenet. If you need help, somebody will help you. So I started making these pieces, and I haven't stopped. Um, I I guess I will stop when I feel like there's nothing to say, you know, I've exhausted that topic, but I don't know.
Before we hear more about impossible monuments, I wanted Marianne to go into more detail about the 32 years between getting her MFA in 1978 and visiting Lebanon in 2010.
What happened in between was I got a couple of residencies, first to the McDowell Foundation, and the McDowell Colony is the oldest residency program in the United States, and you're just put in the middle of these kind of incredible thinkers. And that got me started to try and look at what are the alignments in my work that I've never specifically said that was there. So like even seemingly incidental things like the way I paint is very calligraphic sometimes. And what's that about? And I've always been interested in architecture. And I'm always reading about the way images are integrated into architecture. So then I started to seriously consider that what I needed was a much stronger foundation in history, in geography, in philosophy, in the political overlay of these various countries, including Lebanon. So I applied for a grant with Art Matters Foundation in New York, and they gave me money to do research based on a migration out of the Middle East. Really, it's the Near East. There really is no Middle East, but well, that's a whole other discussion. To follow a migration that my family was a part of that happened at the turn of the 20th century on the heels of the Ottoman Empire collapsing, going through Europe and into the Americas. So I went to Paris, and I was for 2 weeks in residence at the Arab World Institute, which was kind of an incredible thing. And then I went to Mexico City and was given access to archives and historical records in Mexico City of Arab influence in Mexico. And little by little, I started seeing the associations. And always something would surface that I had no idea, and other people had no idea, was there. And so I found myself attracted to the tendrilled information over the dominant information. And I became very aware that there is a dominant discussion in all of these historical surveys of countries that are not within our necessary in our purview. And if there was some sort of patronizing or colonializing of a certain section of the world, then that perspective is the one that you got to read about. And so I found that really my job was to try and find what are people on the ground saying. So I took the record of that migration at the turn of the 20th century and started comparing it to citizen journalists that are recording and broadcasting and uploading information on the web today. So those 200-year distanced events are feeding my work. I'd have to say that the work I'm doing now is much more specific. So I feel that the most important piece of my conceptual reasoning is that there is an event or some sort of historical record that I can point to for people and say, this happened, and I'm trying to interpret what happened. So, for example, I've been doing a series called This Trembling Turf.
This Trembling Turf is a series of 60 by 48-inch clayboard with fine swirls of white pigment that almost looks like a cross between an animal's fur and a landscape. And when you look at them long enough, they actually appear as if they are moving. Links to photos of this trembling turf are in this episode's description.
That series is based on when I was in Beirut doing a residency. I got to go to Beirut. It sounds like I'm constantly in residencies, and I've been pretty lucky, but I'm not constantly in residencies. But I am targeting residencies so that I can get more learned about these things. And when I was in Beirut, I had access to the Arab Image Foundation, which is this marvelous photographic foundation that was started by artists and photographers to give and keep a visual record of the region. And while I was flipping through a book, I found that in a very short couple of paragraphs, that there is most likely a mass grave under the largest, well, the only, not largest, the only golf course in Beirut. And no one would confirm that. Robert Fisk will confirm it because he wrote a book that includes that actual event. But nobody would confirm it in my questioning. I think for obvious politic reasons, it's adjacent to a Palestinian neighborhood. There's an agreement, obviously, between the golf course and the Palestinian leadership. There is some sort of desire, and who can blame them, for hiding what was a really horrible event. I'm making it sound like I only look for tragedy, but what that does for me is it allows me to say, what don't I know about? And I don't know about forensic anthropology. So that event that nobody would confirm led me to try and understand how things are found underground. And so I started researching anthropology and forensic anthropology, and they have devices that when there is something solid, it blips. So if you look at the drawings that I've done called this trembling turf, in all of them, it's trying to do a cross-section of the ground where something might be, and there are blips in it. And that's how so many things have been uncovered in modern technology. And I don't know if, you know, is it important that people confirm that there might be a mass grave? Of course it is, you know, but there isn't a country on the planet that doesn't have the same kind of, I'd have to say, tormented past. And so what I'm interested in is, what's the footprint? You know, what is the footprint of these various things? I'm almost hesitant to bring it up because it's such a sensitive topic. I mean, I think another part of Lebanon that people just, they cannot wrap their minds around this is that the Palestinian refugee population in Lebanon is at least half its population. And it's 50 years in. And there's, you would go into a neighborhood, it's not a camp. I don't know what people are imagining, but they're very integrated, but they have no rights. You know, really, no. You can't even go visit a pal in one of the neighborhoods if you don't have some sort of permission to do so. It's kind of, it's powerful, but I'm not a scholar. I'm not versed on how it works. I just know that it's sensitive. There's huge political overflow on the various factions that are operating in Lebanon. And I wouldn't want to begin to act like or look like or seem that I have any kind of authority about it. I just stumbled onto a strange little fact. In this painting that I'm working on, usually it's all connected together, but it's called Slipstream by the Light of the Moon. And I do think about my titles. I think seriously and strongly, and I angst over good titles. And it's called Slipstream because I did an exhibition that was the double meaning of words. So slipstream is the obvious one of the wake behind a boat. A second layered meaning for slipstream is to be pulled along against your will. So I wanted to make a painting that was about the sensation of being in a boat, trying to escape some circumstance, always doing it in the dead of night because you don't want to be discovered. And that's kind of where this painting went. So this piece is called Slipstream by the Light of the Moon.
The piece Marianne is talking about is Part of the Map is Not the Territory, and it is one with which visitors often spend a great deal of time. Much like this trembling turf, it is a large black clay board with fine swirls of white ink. At first, it almost seems abstract, but after you read Mary Ann's carefully crafted title, it becomes clear what you were looking at. That's something else we definitely wanted to learn more about, the titles for Marianne's work.
Right now, I feel like the titles that I'm using are nuanced, and their intention is to get somebody to be curious. It's not for them to hop on my train, so to speak. It's more for them to get curious about why I would make something and what its source material is. So a lot of the work that I've done in the last few years around these series always has something that I've written that explains the source material so that people are, in some ways, it's a different kind of respect for the viewer to say I'm not just making this stuff up out of the ether, but also to say I'm just one person giving it a go, you know, trying to understand what has proven to be a really volatile situation in contemporary times. And I feel like my titles are really sometimes quite accurate. You know, there's another piece that I'll have in the show in Portland called This Impossible Monument Flotsam. And I'll speak about that just a little bit because I came onto the narrative behind that piece by accident. I'd been invited to do a talk, and there happened to be a table set up by Doctors Without Borders. And I started talking to this nurse about why I was at this festival and what my talk was, which had to do with this work, and his work. And he was working in Yemen. And people don't realize that Doctors Without Borders is often the go-to organization for a lot of things that they don't advertise. And in this case, they had been approached by Yemeni fishermen who were coming across the belongings and the remains of people trying to cross the Mediterranean and not succeeding, and that they knew that there had to be a respectful way, and it was important in the religion, most likely, to manage these findings. So Doctors Without Borders was teaching fishermen how to respectfully retrieve the lost remains of these people. And it just got me. And so I started thinking about what would that be like? You're a fisherman, you're out just doing your job, and you pull in your catch, and there's something entirely different than what you imagined would be in the catch. And how do you normalize that, and how do you give it some level of reverence under the circumstances? So I made that piece. Flotsam is what gets thrown overboard.
Impossible Monuments Flotsam hangs in a corner of The Map Is Not the Territory, and visitors often spend a great deal of time with it. Marianne's work balances perfectly with the 7 other artists in the exhibition, and it has been an honor to showcase her work. Upon my first visit to Marianne's studio, I was certain that her perspectives aligned perfectly with the show's themes.
The humor in this is when she came to my studio, I thought I had to convince her to let me into this exhibition. I was kind of stunned that she wanted to come talk to me. And so I probably just bored her to tears with 900 stories. But it all came down to this kind of cross-referencing and overlaying of kind of conceptual reasoning behind the artist that she was thinking about. And she just said she was stumped. She didn't have a title. And so in my research, in all these places I've had the opportunity to go to, I remembered that I had stumbled onto this philosopher who was actually a semanticist. And he wrote a paper and gave a talk called The Map Is Not the Territory. And what his premise is, in the Cliff Notes version, is that the world as we understand it is basically neurologically wired to who you are. You can only understand so much as what your own, you know, cranium can process. And but it also brought up for me the fact that The map is not the territory means there that the territory is psychological. The territory is spiritual. The territory is not lines in the sand. The territory is how you understand parameters. And if you, for instance, have had a very constricted life experience, your notion of parameters and borders and boundaries is going to be very different than somebody who's had the capacity to move around the world. And I also liked that the whole notion of mapping. I mean, mapping is, everyone's intrigued with mapping. Who isn't? And because, first of all, you know that even if you look at a map, when you get to that place, there's not any way that there's going to be a necessarily definitive identifying of that's where you are. You have to trust it. You have to really trust it. And I think that with this exhibition, for me, this concept is the overlay of all the work I'm doing. The map is not the territory. The territory is how humans treat one another. The territory is the footprint of cultures trying to reinvent themselves when they're forced into movement. The territory is the alliances that you make that either give you the freedom that you need to think yourself through a circumstance, or it constricts your ability to pull yourself out of something that could be detrimental. And some of it is certainly by design, and some of it's by happenstance. So I feel like if my work does nothing right now than make people look at a part of the world that they would never put on their radar, then I did my job. That's what I want.
Curating an exhibition with living artists is especially collaborative, and Marianne's suggestion for the show's title is a perfect example. Over these past 8 episodes of the podcast, we've heard everybody's interpretation of "the map is not the territory." And although they differed in many ways, their thoughts often overlapped. I encourage the 8 artists to share their thoughts about the title with one another leading up to the exhibition, as well as their research. That's another thing about the artists. They often have a thirst for knowledge, and there is usually a lot of research involved.
Well, research is really key to the work that I'm doing now. I mean, I am kind of a news wonk, and I do read a lot of articles. I wish I was more of a literature wonk and read more books, but I find that I read more articles than books. And I find that the research gives me some sort of handle on what my particular fascination might be. And sometimes the research tells me not to go there. Don't go there. There's no way that I can comfortably or ethically address the idea. And I think that ethics is a big piece of my thinking all the time with this work. It behooves me to make sure that whatever the topic is for me is respectful of its source. And I think it's really easy to be sidetracked by the fascination of creativity and to not understand that it could impact someone in a negative way, and to really understand that before you put something out in the world. So, you know, my personal identity is what triggered me wanting to make this work. But my personal identity is minuscule in the long and short of it. I mean, I feel an important alliance with people of Arab descent, because I think it's kind of one of the last closeted communities in America. People are, especially Arab men, are really hesitant to tell people that they have some sort of Arab association with, particularly in this political climate. And so in that way, I feel that it's important that I identify myself as having these kinds of cultural and familial ties. But the story is really about how people normalize seemingly unnormal circumstances, and what could that look like, and how can I in some way take research and take my connections and take my misgivings and my need to be better informed and put it with some sort of aesthetic framework into the public domain. And I feel like I'm as close as I've ever been with this work. Well, my working practice is that I work all the time. I mean, I'm very well aware that everything I touch is not golden, you know, and I'm not naturally talented like some people are, where they can just, whatever they do is like, you just want to bow down. So I understand it as I'm a workhorse. I have to keep my chops up just like an athlete. You know, you just have to keep your chops up. And that for me is drawing and painting. So the wall behind you is a wall that's notes from these various residencies and ideas that I've garnered from things I've found. And sometimes there are ideas that I just try not to edit. I mean, that's one piece of my process right now, is just to go with an idea, just make it, give it a face if you can, and then you edit. You know, it's like, well, that's, I don't know how to realize that, or that's not as interesting to me as something else. And so I draw a lot, and I think a lot. And then sometimes I just work. Making sculptural pieces is new. I'm most noted for being a two-dimensional worker. And so when I first started bringing out these 3D pieces and these installation pieces, even though I had made them before, I just was not given the support to continue them. There's a lesson in there somewhere, but I'm too late for that. But I felt like, well, I certainly think dimensionally, so I should be able to embrace the full range of possibilities. I have not made videos. I'm hesitant to make videos, but people have asked me if I ever will, and I don't know. But I feel really satisfied by using my ideas in a variety of forms. And some forms make more sense in some circumstances than others. So I'd have to say, so it's just a kind of a daily practice of coming in and looking around and, you know, grappling with demons like all artists do, like nobody really cares about this, you know, and making sure that I care about it, and then try and bring it to fruition. It's never boring, I will say that, yeah.
If you've listened to the other episodes or been through the exhibition, you know that two major themes are decolonization and centering Indigenous values.
There's everything that I'm working on has been affected in some way by colonization. There's no question, you know. So, subjugation of some sort. It's the human condition of, you know, somebody pulling rank on somebody else, and it just is in the hands of the observer to either not allow that to happen or acquiesce, and I'm just trying to understand it. But I don't know that I'm not a scholar, you know. I'm just curious and trying to follow my own curiosity about what I think are verifiable and sometimes very much lauded or exposed histories that I want other people to know about. Can anybody who's thinking about history or geography or the political ramifications of actions not bump into Indigenous territory? So in that sense, you know, I'm of course as complicitous as the next person, but my work is not about Indigenous communities. I'm very well aware that I'm on Indigenous land. My studio is on the banks of the Duwamish River. And so there's no way that I can not come in here and, you know, show my respect for the history and the people that were here before me.
Marianne is absolutely right. We should all be aware of the peoples who were on our lands before they were colonized and recognize them regularly. The Portland Art Museum is situated in downtown Portland, Multnomah County, Oregon, a place which rests on the traditional village sites of the Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas bands of Chinook, Tualatin, Kalapuya, Molalla, and many other tribes who made their homes along the Columbia River. We at the Portland Art Museum make an effort to recognize the indigenous peoples of the Portland area, on whose ancestral lands the museum now stands, paying respect to their elders past and present. We realize that you are listening to the podcast and aren't necessarily in or around the museum, but we would like you to please take a moment to consider the legacies of violence, displacement, migration, settlement, and resilience that brought us to where we all are today. Violence, displacement, migration, settlement, and resilience are themes that have been brought up by all of the artists in The Map Is Not the Territory during this series of the Portland Art Museum podcast. And each artist was chosen specifically for their contributions in uncovering those truths in their own ways. Marianne is no exception. And though she has been a working artist for a long time, it is our honor to showcase her work in this exhibition.
I have a really strong reputation in Seattle. I've had lots of opportunities. I am not on the radar of curators for some reason. So to have Grace chase me down and want to talk to me about this exhibition was a breakthrough. You know, I haven't ever shown my work with any of these artists. And again, I think that goes back to, I think it's been hard for, possibly for curators to weave me into exhibitions that I don't know that I would even have my own work be a lead-in with this kind of a community. I would just want the work to be interesting and people want to see it. So I'm not looking for circumstances that would have all these social overlays in the work of other artists and myself. And so to be in the company of these people is kind of a remarkable thing. And I'm really curious to see where there are relational moments between our work. I know that I appreciate that there are some people who seem to embrace more heavily certain aspects of their work than others. There's some that are certainly aligned with what we would consider to be aesthetics. But many of these artists, I think, are using materials and sources that don't fall under the norm of aesthetic concerns or practices, and I think that's really interesting. I could be wrong about that. I mean, I'm sure that the people who paint want to make good paintings, and the people who make videos want to make good videos, and you know, the people that make sculptural things, it matters to them that it has presence. But I don't know that the reason they make that work is for what we consider to be more traditional notions about why art would end up in a museum. So that's what's interesting about this show for me. And you know, the other part of it is, I mean, I feel a little disingenuous sometimes because most people think that all the exodus out of the Middle East right now, the whole with the Syrian crisis, is across water. Actually, over 80% of people are crossing by land. They're not doing it by water. So I almost spank myself for getting so fascinated by it. But it's not the, I mean, the pieces I've made are not just aligned with water crossings, but that's, I would hate for people to think that the drama of the events of migrants trying to cross water is why I would make work about this. I think we all have to be really careful that we don't, you know, theatricize these moments. Somebody asked me what I thought of Ai Weiwei's moment with the child on the beach. And my knee-jerk reaction was I thought it was horrible. But at the same time, he's a powerful figure and he's using his status to bring people along in a topic that maybe they don't want to think about.
If you are listening to this episode on the day of its release, there are only a few days left to see The Map Is Not the Territory. If you haven't had the opportunity to visit the museum or won't in the next few days, Please keep an eye on these artists to see where their work will be shown in the future. Should you have the chance to see Marianne's work in the future, please keep her following words in mind.
My experience so far with my work in various stages of my career has been that there is an emotional response to my work. I don't want people to come away feeling minimized or shamed by my work. I would hope that what happens for them is that they would have never imagined it in its iteration as I've done it, and that they would find themselves, when they flip through a newspaper or a website, that they catch something that came because my work suggested it. And that's about all I can hope for. And I hope that people walk away with an after image, because that's where work lives. If there's no after image, then you've got to get back to the drawing board. I would have never imagined I'd be making the work I'm making now, not in a million years, not even 10 years ago. And I think for myself, as an artist who's had more experience, one of the things that happens to you is that you think, well, I have nothing to lose. What do I have to lose to venture into territory with my work that people are not expecting from me? I have nothing to lose. And everything to gain from my own maturation and curiosity and enrichment of thinking about all these narratives that were always kind of trailing me, kind of behind me, my little ghosts. And I just am grateful for being able to make this work. I'm grateful to Grace for having confidence in this work. I'm really grateful to my art dealer, Jim Harris, because I went full circle on him like 3-4 years ago and said, I'm going to do this thing. And are you with me? And he's been great, you know. I mean, he's been very, very affirming about it. And as have my peers, which comes down to the final thing I want to say, which is my peer group, other artists, they're the ones that probably I make the work to. And I want to have the respect of my peers. And anything after that is just luck.
Thank you for listening to the Portland Art Museum podcast. I'm John Richardson, this podcast's producer. I'd like to thank everyone who has been submitting their episode ideas at pam.to/podcast idea. Your suggestions have been fantastic and integral to the concept of a community-driven podcast. Because bringing these ideas to life takes time, the next episode will be an artist talk from our archives, where we invite a local artist to speak about their work as it relates to a piece from the museum's permanent collection. If you haven't already, please be sure to subscribe, and we would love it if you would rate and review the podcast if you use an app with such an option. I'd like to thank the 8 artists from The Map Is Not the Territory, Grace Cook Anderson, and you, the listener.